that people that don't vote because they say the system doesn't serve them, they're creating that. They're actually allowing those who do not serve them, right? The small minority of wealthy developer, you know, people who are in bed with the developers, they get into power, and they're certainly not going to serve those many numbers of people who don't believe in voting. So it just makes no sense to not vote, because if those people that are so skeptical of voting and so cynical and think it's useless, if they voted, they would actually be improving their lot. They would be improving their lives. What about the idea of top-down versus bottom-up? I know that was a theme that you and Colleen Hardwick, your running mate, essentially we talked a lot about in the by-election. It struck me as a top-down kind of dictatorial system where the politicians in power dictate what will happen, what the policies will be, and don't really listen or don't really care about the people at the bottom. That seems very anti-democratic to me. So can you explain how that's played out, like with the current municipal government, this top-down sort of dictatorial method of running the city?
I will be hesitant to use any terms like dictatorial, just because I don't want to be seen as like a fearmonger. But there is something to be said right now about some of the legislation we see coming out of the provincial NDP, out of the province. David Eby at the helm, talking about Bill 44 and Bill 15, 46 and 47 as well, have been very negative bills. These are essentially pieces of legislation that consolidate power, and they give the province the final say. They basically give the province all the power when it comes to making decisions about land use and development, which were formerly decisions made by the city. And that was up to city council to make those decisions. And largely now we're going to be seeing decisions being made by appointed officials, whereas those decisions used to be made by elected officials. So right there, that's a small failure in democracy. There's also been a few other bills that the province has brought in the last few years that have seen the dissolution of formerly elected bodies being replaced by appointed officials, which is never good. That is, I think it's well referred to as empire building. That's where you take you build out the bureaucracy. And I'm not some Doge guy. And I've always thought that bigger government is better. I'm not one of those like rah-rah free market small government. Absolutely not. But I like Rush Limbaugh. I have no love for Rush Limbaugh.
But
that rhetoric.
I think though that I know what you're saying. Part of the issue with having this kind of like imperial style of statehood, and again, this is something that this is just my general kind of anecdotal observations of this sort of thing, looking both at Canada, the US, and other places as well. There's this sort of attitude of like, oh, the systems are broken, people are unhappy, you just got to let us do things, it'll work. This is particularly big in the States with the MAGA movement and the Trump administration, right? Like, we're just going to do stuff that works, and we don't really have time for the accountability that is required of like a more traditionally democratic and reliable state. So instead, we're just going to move to these models where it's like you might vote for one guy and then I'm just going to appoint everybody and we're just going to do it all, and we're going to do a lot of it in secret, or it's going to be a lot less transparent, but we're just going to like get stuff done. But again, obviously the issue then becomes that like you, the citizen, are no longer involved in that process, and you can no longer nearly as easily hold the individuals who are making really important and big decisions to account, right? Like, they're not up for election. They're not really accessible to you. They're being appointed. And a lot of times, it creates a lot of screens between the voter and those people making the decisions, because the only person you really know is the person that you're voting for. Right.
We have to be careful about making blanket statements with respect to elected versus unelected or elected versus appointed officials. Let me give you an example. So Trump in the United States, when a judge makes a decision against him, finding, you know, one of his actions or one of his executive orders or whatever unconstitutional, if that judge is not an elected judge, but rather is appointed in the United States, some judges, depending on which state and which jurisdiction, some judges are elected and some judges are appointed. So Trump will say, well, that judge that ruled against me was an appointed judge, wasn't even elected, and I was elected president. Therefore, that judge is undemocratic. What just happened, that judge ruling against me, that was anti-democratic. And that's fallacious. So the mere fact that that judge was appointed, in my view, doesn't make the judge's decision wrong or undemocratic. So everybody can't be elected, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so, well, so oftentimes it's elected officials that are doing undemocratic things. So I would argue that Trump is anti-democratic. He's the one that's trying to usurp the Constitution in the United States. That's trying to consolidate power. That's trying to take over things like tariffs, which there's no basis for the president in the United States making tariffs like that. But he was elected. So the mere fact that someone's elected doesn't make everything that person does democratic. And the mere fact that someone's appointed doesn't mean that whatever that person does is undemocratic.
No, I agree. And I think a good way to ground this discussion would be to give an example of the housing situation in Vancouver, the housing crisis in Vancouver, which has very much been facilitated. We used to have, there was an era where there was all these different area plans developed in the city with these neighborhoods. So the city would go into a neighborhood and develop the Grandview Woodland area plan or the Downtown East Side area plan. This was a plan that established the rate of change. It worked with residents over a long period of time to hear what the residents wanted, and the residents were working with planners at the city, and this was all overseen by elected officials, by city councilors. And there were these great robust plans that were a reflection of the community's values. It was a reflection of what how the community wanted the rate at which growth was going to accelerate. Recently, the city has basically thrown out all of those plans. The Grandview Woodland Area Plan, they've just disregarded all this years of work that's been done, all this years of important consultation that's been done in the name of efficiency. It's the language of efficiency, right? This is why Ken Sim wanted to abolish the elected park board. It'll be more efficient. We'll save money. This is largely the rhetoric of Doge as well. A lot of people have pointed at those kinds of plans, those kinds of neighborhood plans, and said, that's the reason we have the housing crisis, because these plans weren't ambitious enough. It's very dangerous. It's very dangerous rhetoric, because that's absolutely not the reason why we have a housing crisis in Vancouver. These plans were not the culprit in no way. And now we see that Ken Sim is getting ready to open up the Downtown East Side area plan. And he's going, which will essentially, he wants to allow more market rate development, which will displace and effectively, you know, sign the death warrant for thousands of residents, because he's going to let his buddies like Chip Wilson come in and build a bunch of towers in that area and displace of extremely low income residents. He's doing, we're doing away with the Downtown East Side area or the Grandview Woodland area plan in my neighborhood, Commercial Drive, in order to build a bunch of huge towers, which are going to increase rent for everyone and increase land value in the area. So this is an example. This is an example of the top-down model being replaced by a otherwise grassroots bottom-up model that was better in almost every respect. More democratic.
So you're saying the top-down model is replacing the grassroots bottom-up.
Yes. Yeah. It has.
Right.
Yeah.
And the grassroots bottom-up was more democratic, and the top-down benefits a very few people and actually raises what real estate values, housing prices, and drives out people at the bottom.
So why? So taking like a less extreme example in the downtown, he said the Grandview Woodland area, a lot of people more on the kind of ABC side of things would say, well, you know, someone like Chip is going to come in there. He's going to put in, I don't know if it's Chip or not, but they're going to put in a bunch of towers, right? And that's going to increase the number of available units in the neighborhood. So how would that negatively affect the people that are already there? And how would that, as you said in your just a moment ago, actually increase rent over time, or potential living costs over time?
First of all, you have to think about the way that rezoning inflates land value. If you take, there's like a, you say you have a mom and pop shop that's a corner store, and then there's like an apartment above it, and that's zoned for two stories or three stories. What BC Land Assessment does is they come in and they'll rezone it, or they'll reassess it for 25 stories. They assess it at what's called highest and best use. Highest and best use, which means that essentially that property is being underutilized. And all that air above that land is now worth way more. So say that property is worth $5 million, and now they increase the value to $15 or $20 million. This is a process that has been playing out in Vancouver for many, many years. And it's a violent process of increasing land value. And when you increase land value, a rising tide, as they say, rising tide lifts all boats. It has an inherently inflationary effect. And then the idea of the supply thing. So you're building all of these bunch more units. They're all going to be rental units at Broadway and Commercial. They're all going to be luxury units. Won't that decrease the pressure on the market? Supply and demand. Well, supply and demand is not a natural effect. Supply and demand is institutionally facilitated, and it always has been. It's not, the critics of mine and others will say, no, you got to let the market do its thing. There's this magic there where the market, it'll take pressure off the market. This is true if you're building the right type of housing. If the exemption that the Broadway and Commercial development is getting is all new developments in Vancouver have to be a minimum 20% below market. They're saying that only 10% of the floor space needs to be designated for below market rentals. And again, I'm kind of getting the weeds of urban planning talk, but that's the way it is. So they're giving them, it's a West Bank development, a total boon, right? And the reason why it won't take pressure off the market is because it'll allow for more, a higher influx of new neighbors, people who can afford those rents, and all of the rent around there will go up. If the average rent in the surrounding area is like $1,850 for a one bedroom right now, but the new apartments in the high rise, the luxury high rise, they're getting $2,500, then those rents in the surrounding area will go up. And a good example to use is investment in any stock, right? So if there is, say you have an electric vehicle company, and they are about to open up their first round of, they're about to go public, open up in a round of investment. If they open up and allow for 25,000 shares to be sold off to investors, the other remaining shares, what will happen to their value? Go through the roof, because everyone's going to buy. Everyone's going to buy. And this is the way that it works. This is the problem with market housing. If you develop non-market housing, which is housing that can't be bought or sold, it is outside of the market, it does not have that same effect of increasing land value, of increasing rent, or increasing property tax. So again, it's much like when you're allowing for more increased investment. Even though the rental units increase investment will allow for the stock, the value of that thing will go up and up. And that's what we've seen in Vancouver for a long time now.
Okay, thanks, Theodore. You are listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm Michael Robert Kaditz. I'm here with Theodore Abbott and Hale Rothery. So, Theodore, earlier you talked a little bit about the concept of voodoo economics, I suppose, also maybe voodoo, urban planning theory, urban land use theory, and all that. And you've just been talking about some of the fallacies that have been perpetrated by the developers when they essentially get areas rezoned for taller buildings, for towers. And I believe you were saying that it actually does not make housing more affordable. That it does would be a voodoo theory, right? It's just not the case.
This is the idea of trickle down. It is essentially trickle down economics repackaged into housing,
like Reaganomics.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. And so, but in urban planning, there's a term for it. It's called filtering theory. And the idea is that if you build these new units, they eventually filter down to the underclasses. That's literally the theory. So, like, build a new building, and in 25 years, and the truth is there actually is some validity to that argument, but filtering takes way too long. Filtering will take pressure off the market by like 1% or 0.5%, as some studies out of Berkeley have told us, because San Francisco has the same problem right now. And so there's been some interesting studies that say, yeah, okay, so filtering or trickle-down housing will eventually take prices. Prices will slowly come down over 40 years. Like 0.5%. So, to kind of cap that off, if building more and more and more of one type of housing, of market rate housing, were to bring prices down, then places like Vancouver or Hong Kong would have some of the most affordable housing in the world, because Hong Kong is like a sea of towers. It's all market rate, and it's a highly, highly unaffordable. Same with Vancouver, and I do think we need more We need more housing in Vancouver. Absolutely. It's just my point has always been that we need the right kind. Right. We need the right type.
Right. So I wanted to jump from that to the idea about like what characterizes democracy. So I would assert that one of the characteristics of democracy has to do with like truth and science, like fact-based theory, fact-based decision-making, and not this voodoo stuff, right? So we have other examples of that here in Vancouver that I wanted to mention. So I've been working with a group called Stanley Park Preservation Society, and we've been opposing this huge logging operation that's been taking place for the last year and a half in Stanley Park, of all places. So tens of thousands of trees have been cut down in Stanley Park under what I would call voodoo science, under this claim, which is very, very shaky, that somehow removing trees from Stanley Park is going to make Stanley Park safer, that there's this big danger in Stanley Park, there's going to be wildfire, trees are going to be falling on people. And it's like after all these decades, after all these centuries, suddenly the current city government decided that there's this big danger in Stanley Park, and they cite global warming. But they haven't produced any substantive evidence on why global warming is suddenly going to cause a rainforest, a coastal rainforest, to become a big fire hazard. And that's really refuted by all the experts. Our group brought in many experts with PhDs, experts on fire science, experts on tree risk. And there's almost no substantiation for this claim. So it just strikes me as being something else the city of Vancouver is doing, which is reminiscent of what you're describing. They have these like voodoo theories about urban planning and land use and rents becoming more affordable and property values going and getting lower if they build more high rises. Well, they have this theory about if we cut down a lot of trees, then everyone's going to be safer. When in fact, there haven't been any disasters or anyone killed in Stanley Park, maybe one person in 100 years by a falling tree. And there's just no science to support this claim that we're on the verge of a disastrous wildfire in a rainforest. It just makes no sense. And yet the city government of Vancouver is just embarking upon these major policy decisions with very little substantive factual or scientific evidence. So they have this voodoo theory about wildfires engulfing a rainforest. So do you see the parallel that I'm trying to draw here? There's, to me, it's undemocratic that that science is ignored, that substantive, substantial, proven theories are ignored, whether it be tree risk, wildfire risk, or whether it be with regards to housing and urban planning. They just seem to be ignored by a municipal government which is intent on making policy decisions on very poorly supported theories, which kind of voodoo theories.
I think that there's a pretty large detachment. What this comes down to for me is the form over substance, and I mentioned that earlier. And this is the aesthetics of politics, and it's the aesthetics of policy. This plays out largely in who gets politics in terms of who gets elected. If it reads well, and if you can wave your hands around it well, people will accept it. People do not want nuance. People do not want complicated answers to their questions. And when I was running, I dipped my toe into the world of electoral politics. One of the things I learned was people would ask me like a question, and I would. They would ask me like a policy question, and I would start giving them this answer that was it wasn't cut and dried. Like it wasn't straightforward. I think I confused a few people because they would look down at their bingo card of like political like alignments, and they didn't know where to stamp me. Like, and so I quickly learned, because I got burnt a few times, people like pointing, calling me names, this and that. I learned to just give them the straightforward answer. Because for fear of being misrepresented or mislabeled, and that was an interesting learning experience for me. Like with the logging, they don't want all the nuance and the detail and the minutia.
Well, yeah, well, that's the catch-22 of politics. Unfortunately, is people, obviously people and many politicians, I believe, they want to be honest. We want honest politicians, but also honest politicians generally don't win. right? It's not a kind of, especially the mediums that, you know, politicians play on, don't play super well to thorough, honest, complex answers like you're trying to give. And that's where things like, obviously, propaganda and stuff come in, where it becomes much easier to sell a simple lie than a complicated truth. And I think it's really hard for any politician, unfortunately, to not fall into that system, because unfortunately it works. It's effective at getting votes in many cases.
Which leads us to another characteristic of democracy, which is education. It's well known that MAGA supporters, Trump supporters in the United States, tend to be have less education, and those with college educations tend to be less MAGA supporters and more supporters of Democrats. So why is that? Well, it's because education, especially higher education, especially philosophical education, as we know, Hale, you know, we've taken critical thinking, helps us to understand the world in shades of gray and in nuance. And we're capable, if we're more highly educated, we're capable of understanding more complex reasoning rather than just accept the simplistic one-fits-all-size solutions to problems. And so there's like this inherent problem, which is that if we can say, which I believe we can, that the world is nuanced, issues are nuanced, we've given examples of that today, and you don't have the capability of understanding the nuances, then you're going to tend to swallow the narratives that are promoted by those appealing to simplistic thought, when the problems themselves are not simplistic. So I keep thinking about Galileo times, when before Galileo did his research and it got propagated out to the public, everyone thought that it made complete sense that the sun revolves around the earth, because, I mean, look, it's intuitive, right? You see the sun come up in the east and go down in the west, so obviously the sun's moving around the earth. That was the simplest intuitive explanation. But then people who were educated began to understand that it was actually more complicated than that. And it might appear that way. It's more nuanced, right? It's actually the earth that's revolving around the sun, and it just has the appearance of the reverse. So it's the same thing now. You know, people tend to go for the simplistic solutions when that's not the way the world is. So those of us who understand the nuance in the world have an inherent problem. Like, there's an innate problem here, which is, how do we get people who are not so educated and can't see things in shades of gray to understand without ourselves oversimplifying things? And how do we convince people who aren't really capable of understanding shades of gray?
This comes down to our truth finding systems, I think, and I think I've been talking a bit about this recently. We are overwhelmed with data. And we don't have the time or the capacity to be like proofing things out, to be like writing the equations for these things, and so it's always been that we rely on something like the coherence theory of truth. Like, you know, you rely on little bundles of truth and systems. You rely on people to be, you rely on your community. You rely on the New York Times to be like the arbiter of truth. And because you don't have time in your day independently to find truth on your own. And if you're trying to walk around with your magnifying glass and find it, you'll never find it. So I really believe that as community becomes sort of degraded, eroded on various levels, our ability to know what's what is becoming challenged. Fundamentally, and I think that people's access to media is a huge part of this. The way that we consume like news, like a lot of people in my age group have zero access to news, and I think that we're largely, and this is kind of comes back to urban planning, I think we're also building communities that are less cohesive, and we exchange information in a way that's different now, and it's has less depth, and so. On a very macro level, the way that we process information is breaking down, because we're just overwhelmed with the magnitude of the data that we're dealing with.
And that's why authoritarian leaders around the world go straight for the press. They want to control the press. They want to suppress information. They want the press to perhaps self-censor. And Trump's doing this now in the United States. He's putting pressure on the major media outlets to self-censor and control information, because people who only have a small capacity for fact-finding, and they just listen to the, you know, their news report, an hour news or half an hour news or not even that much every day, they're going to get what the press tells them, and that's all. And so if the government can control the media and control the type of information that the media covers or doesn't cover, they're going to be able to control what people think.
And also, too, I think there's, like, as you were saying, there's the one side of what you're saying there, right, Mikey, which is the states can go directly to the press. They can go to the press systems. They can have influence on that. There's also, Theodore, which you were saying as well, especially particularly with younger people, but all generations, this move towards different types of media mediums, and particularly like social media. We think about things like TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, whatever it's going to be. People interact with those things differently than they did, say, reading the New York Times 20 or 30 years ago or whatever it might be. Even more when those are often corporations which can censor themselves and can be influenced by the state. But also, too, they often create a kind of media that really is not the best at getting across complex ideas and complex situations. It's a lot of really short form, quick, fast, and fragmented ideas that I think cause a lot of times more apathy or confusion in the populace, which a lot of times for state organizations and stuff like that is ideal, right? If people like don't know what's going on or can't handle it or there's too much stuff, I'm just like going to kind of back out and I'm not going to participate.
You're going to be more and more atomized. Yeah. And more and more in your own way, a completely individualized person, which we have told, which postmodernism has told us, post-structuralism has told us, is the zenith of existence, is to be completely your own person. It is simultaneously leading us to our epistemological and cultural deaths, because we can't find anything. And of course you can't find anything because you're disconnected. I talk about the death of the water cooler sometimes. Like the fact that there's no longer like a water cooler show that everyone's watching. Like, oh, like how is Breaking Bad? We're all watching Breaking Bad. And everyone's, you come to the water cooler, you're like, I'm watching Andor. You know. And so the way that we're being mediated because of the saturation of media is causing us to be more disconnected. There's less of a line of continuity between what we're all talking about because there's just so much happening.
Well, and the profile self becomes more real than the real self, right? And that's, you know, it might be a completely individual thing, but in a great irony, you end up just kind of looking like everyone else in your echo chamber bubble type scenario. And it becomes really, really difficult to look at other things critically and differently. It just is in many cases, it's no longer actually possible.
Right. Okay, we'll have to leave it at that today. We've been talking about what democracy is and some of the issues on the provincial and local level, especially here in Vancouver. Thank you very much, Hale Rothery, my fellow Vancouver Island University alumnus. Thank you so much, Theodore Abbott. Theodore is a critical urbanist, a podcaster, affordable housing advocate, and a recent city council candidate here in Vancouver. Thanks so much for listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Trolling college music so you don't have to. No loyalties, no orthodoxy. Keeping it real, dumb, and organic since 2019. Tune into Home of Burnaby Rock with John on Fridays from 6 to 8 p.m.
On the next Alternative Radio, hear Chalmers Johnson on Blowback, the Consequences of U.S. Foreign Policy. That's Alternative Radio, Wednesday afternoons at 4, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.